Okay, we're going to start on time, which I know goes against all the rules at South by Southwest. But we want to thank all of you for coming. The question is, can the internet make you president? My name is Mark Strama. I'll be the moderator today. I'm a member of the Texas House of Representatives here in Austin. And don't tell anybody I'm here because we're in session right now. I'm supposed to be there. I come to this with a background actually similar to the panelists. Back in 1999, I started a company called NewVoter.com, which was the first company to offer online voter registration services to political websites. We were an ASP. We were acquired very early on by a company in New York called Election.com, and our technology was used by 700,000 Americans to register to vote in the 2000 election. As a Democrat, I wish it had been 700,800 in Florida. But it was still one of the things I've done that I'm most proud of in my life. I then ran for office myself in 2004 in a district here in northern Travis County, which is probably 98% of the district. Well, no, somewhere between 90 and 100% of the district has an email address and checks it a couple of times a week. Very tech-savvy district. And so the internet was an integral part of my campaign. I ran in a district that leans more Republican than Democrat. As I mentioned, I'm a Democrat. I defeated an incumbent Republican by 550 votes in a district that was drawn to elect somebody from the other party. So for me, I think the internet made a tremendous difference. We raised an extraordinary percentage of our money online. But more importantly, we used the internet and technology more generally to make everything we did as a campaign more efficient and more effective. Email has been, you know, our goal in all of our field organizing and block walking has always been to collect as many email addresses as possible and to maintain a relationship with the people I represent by email, which is just an extraordinary tool for politicians because it enables you to have bilateral communication almost for free. And we take advantage of that as much as possible. So that's my story. That's why I'm up here. And I'm going to let each member of the panel introduce himself and why you should be interested in his opinion individually, starting with Patrick Ruffino. Ruffini.
Hi, everyone. Great to be here. Patrick Ruffini. I am currently consulting as an advisor to Rudy Giuliani's Presidential Exploratory Committee. Immediately before this, I was e-campaign director at the RNC, where we were basically handled soup to nuts, email, web, blogosphere, communications at the RNC. In 2004, I was webmaster at Bush Cheney, came to that from another tour at the RNC. We were a pretty incestuous group, I guess, moving back and forth, kind of similar, different organizations, kind of same job titles, but continuing to innovate. And really prior to that, I mean, I was really a grassroots guy on the internet. In the 2000 election, you know, I started a Yahoo group for Bush that was like 700 people. And that was a great accomplishment, I think, at the time. And obviously things have grown a little bit since then, but that was the kind of thing I was doing before then that got me noticed initially at the RNC and picked up there and been doing it pretty much ever since. So that's my story. And I'll turn it over to Mark Suhu.
Mark Suhu, I'm currently working for the McCain 2008 e-campaign team. I'm also serving as Senior Vice President of Campaign Solutions. It's a firm I've been with since 1999, working with Republican candidates kind of at all levels, from local level all the way up through statewide and national. In 2004, we did the Republican National Convention website, as well as the online fundraising for Bush Cheney 04, and I've been working for the RNC, NRCC, other groups like that. So that's Campaign Solutions and my story.
I'm Clay Johnson, and I'm not a Republican. I was in 2005. No need for applause. It's we're a nonpartisan panel, and since I'm outnumbered, we have to play nice. In 2004, I decided to get involved in politics, and somehow managed to become the lead programmer, for the, Dean for America campaign. Prior to that, a few of us, former dean staffers decided to go start a company called Blue State Digital, where we still power democrats.org and Howard Dean's sort of web stuff, as well as now we're working with Barack Obama. And we do everything soup to nuts for a lot of our clients, including, you know, a white label social networking service and a technology platform that is cool and neat and fun, and also online strategy. So, you know, those emails that you get, we write them, and please don't hurt me for them. And yeah, that's I enjoy long walks on the beach, and that's all I got.
Clay, let me start by asking you a question that I think might dispel a myth from people. You know, one of my former political bosses, I was, you know, when the internet was starting to become a factor in politics, said, "Get me some of that internet. How do I buy some of that?" And a lot of people say, you know, Howard Dean figured this out. My thesis has always been, not really, that the internet happened to Dean, not vice versa. 6 months before the caucus, you could Google Howard Dean's name, and the first listing wasn't the Howard Dean official website. It was meetup.com. It was a bunch of people organizing themselves online behind a cause, not top-down, bottom-up. Was that your experience from the campaign?
Well, you know, I get these phone calls a lot from people that say, I do business development for Blue State now, and I'm sort of, I like to call myself a recovering engineer. And I get these phone calls that say, and someone says, "Clay, my name is, you know, John Smith, and I'm running for city council in Atlanta. And, you know, you guys raised $25 million online for Howard Dean, and I too would like $25 million. can you do that for me?" And, I mean, the answer to that is, if I could figure out how to raise $25 million just magically, then I probably wouldn't work anymore. And yeah, I mean, in a direct response to your question, yeah, I think I think the internet, you know, the internet found Dean, and really went to him and made him the internet candidate. Howard Dean didn't, you know, Howard Dean wasn't like, "Well, you know what I'm going to do is, we're going to, you know, get online and get a great website." It was more like, "Let's have a meetup." And people on the ground, you know, I got involved in the Dean campaign by going to a meetup in Atlanta. And then, you know, somehow I got sucked up into Vermont, where it's freezing. I'm never doing that again.
But Clay, is it true that the Dean campaign had to negotiate with Meetup to get the email addresses?
We never got the email addresses.
So who had more email addresses for Dean supporters? The Dean campaign or Meetup.com?
It was almost about equal, and that's the one thing I think that we learned from the Republicans in 2004 was to never let anybody sort of own the relationship between you and your supporters, which the Republicans were exceptionally good at, and it at least it appeared so. I mean, I didn't see, but we weren't so good at. And so Meetup was just sitting on, in Meetup's defense, they couldn't actually do it because it would violate their privacy policy. So they couldn't and wouldn't do so. They were sitting on a bunch of addresses that we couldn't get to.
Have any of the three of you tried to put a price tag on an email address? What's it worth to you as a candidate, as a campaign? Nobody?
Yeah.
Surely there's a number.
There, right? Yeah.
It varies. I mean, it depends on the quality. And the short answer, though, the honest answer is lawyers would probably kill me if I did that. Because then, I mean, that screws every campaign that ever comes after us. Because, I mean, there's widely varying. I mean, it could cost, you know, pennies to, you know, several dollars. But there's no fixed price.
It just depends on where you're getting these lists from. I mean, if these are organically grown people who are actively coming out to you, then yeah, there's a real value in getting those. So in terms of, you know, ROI for online advertising, sure, there's costs in there. But if you're talking about list acquisition and all those other kind of things, like Patrick just said, it varies.
Yeah. So there's two questions here, right? I think, which one is, you know, how much would a campaign pay for an email address? And the other one is, how much does a campaign make off an email address? Yeah. And it, And the first one, the answer to the first one is, I mean, we tell our candidates pretty much, just, or all of our clients, we've got 60 clients, just don't buy email addresses. You're much better off, you know, having, again, to your first question, you're much better off just like, the reason Howard Dean raised $25 million online, let's not kid ourselves, because he was the only guy at the time sort of opposing the war in Iraq, and that resonated with a lot of people. I'm sorry, it's true. He's a great guy.
And civil unions.
Right.
Those were the two issues around which people organized for Dean.
Right. That's where he got his email list from. He gave a great speech, yep. You know. In terms of, you know, what they're worth, it depends on the list too. I mean, they can, you know, you can, a good rule of thumb for us is, you know, at the baseline, a dollar per email address is what you expect to raise from it, over time. But, it depends on the quality of the list.
Do either of y'all advise your candidates against buying email addresses?
It depends on the candidate. I mean, obviously, you know, having an organically grown list that is able to raise $25 million is ideal. But realistically, not every candidate is able to do that. And there are certain situations where list rentals, list acquisitions can be valuable. It just depends on, you know, really the candidate and, you know, how much time they have, how far along they are. You know, if you come to me a week before an election and say, I need to raise $25 million. Well, there's not a whole lot we can do about that to organically get you a list that'll do that. You know, and that's the way politics works sometimes. So,
yeah. And I think that it's key. You made the distinction between rental and acquisition. If I go to an organization, one of the things that I think is maybe, and Clay can maybe dispel this, but I think one of the untold stories of Dean is the move on primary, which happened like a week before this whole September, the whole June 30th fundraising deadline, which is when Dean really exploded onto the scene. But that happened a week before then. And my understanding is everyone who, he won with 40% of the vote. Everyone who voted in that was encouraged to go sign up for the list of, you know, person they supported. And I imagine that a lot of your growth came from that. So
now, there's a guy named Jim Moore who sort of wrote a book a long time ago called the invisible superpower or something like that. And it sort of talks about the sort of, the move on Dean sort of mass of people that sort of tend to float between moment to moment. So I would agree that the move on primary definitely had a big thing going. It also got a lot of media attention. And I think it got on CNN. It got on the news that the move on people were having this primary. And because of that, move on, I mean, did something really brilliant. They got a whole bunch of email addresses. And they somehow got all the candidates to give move on their supporters. Which was really smart on move on's behalf. And that definitely did help out Howard Dean. Although, you know, you can't say he won the primary because in fact, move on said, we're not going to, no one wins unless they get 50%. And so they didn't actually end up endorsing, which I'm a little still bitter about.
Well, I'll just say, Clay, you're right. There are two levels at which I was asking the question. One is, what's it worth when you pay for a list? And it, I think, depends on who you're paying and where the list is coming from. I've never done that in my own campaigns. But the organically grown list that we've gotten from knocking on doors in my district and asking people for their email addresses, we've found to be worth about $10 a name just in fundraising. And obviously much more when you factor in the way you can recruit volunteers from that list, the way you can take those addresses off your mailing list for your direct mail purposes and communicate with those folks electronically and save all the money on postage and printing. So you're right. I mean, nobody's selling lists for $10 an email address, and nobody will ever get that. But when you organically grow your list, we found it to be really really valuable.
And I think one of the things that I would add on here is it's all about the relationship. So, I mean, if you're getting a relationship that's starting out with you buying it, it's inherently less valuable than a relationship where I'm coming to you and saying, hey, I'm really interested in Howard Dean, or I'm really interested in John McCain or whatever. It's a lot more valuable if somebody's coming out and seeking you out and finding it. And in terms of the relationship, you're exactly right. It's not just about fundraising. So it's hard to say, you know, there are certain people who are going to give money to you, and that's obviously an important part of your email list. But just as important is getting people out to a rally, getting them to knock on doors, getting them to write a letter to the editor, getting them to do all the, you know, fundamentals of politics. And so if somebody starts up a new, you know, coalition for you, but doesn't give you a dime, you know, I would argue that, you know, it's still very important to have that new coalition going.
So before we get to that stuff, let's talk about online fundraising for a minute. Which candidates have the most leverage or traction with online fundraising, and what about them gives them that advantage, and how can or should they exploit that opportunity to maximum effect?
I think that I think the landscape is changing a little bit, whereas a little backstory. I mean, I was on the internet in 96, remember going to message boards, and everyone was raving about Harry Brown, the libertarian candidate, and like the Natural Law Party candidate. I mean, it was very much, let's say, an early adopter type crowd. And then it kind of migrated to, you know, John McCain, frenetic energy of the Straight Talk Express in 2000, Howard Dean. I do think that obviously the edge is still going to be there for a candidate who is a populist, who inspires a lot of grassroots energy and is somewhat of an insurgent. But I do think that we are moving toward, there is a model out there for, say, if you're a front runner, if you're Hillary Clinton, if you're Rudy Giuliani, if you're John McCain, I think there's a model out there for those types of candidates because they do inherently have a lot of support. And if they can tie in, there's a lot of media attention focused on them. And if they can tie in to that media attention, to that press attention, to make their big events offline, also their big events online, and collect a lot of email addresses, they're going to raise a lot of money off that list. So I do think, like, I don't think we're necessarily going to see a primary anymore where Howard Dean was way ahead on the internet and left everyone else kind of in the dust. I think probably everyone, you know, all the candidates on this stage at least, I think have the ability to be all competitive at the same time.
I'd agree. I mean, I think you're going to see, you know, your sort of internet rock stars are going to be your offline rock stars, right? It's sort of, and in 2008, I think, is going to be the year of the boring internet. I mean, since getting into politics and sort of doing technology consulting, at least on the Democratic side, I found that, you know, in the nonprofit sectors and sort of the progressive left world, it's still very much, you know, 1999. And you know, it's like working, you know, this is what HTML is. And so because of that, you know, and
what
and,
is it, Clay? I've always wondered that.
it's like C++, apparently. I don't know, it's weird.
It's magic.
Because of that, it's sort of you know, I look at 2001, 2002 is sort of when, you know, the internet sort of got boring, right? Like, okay, everyone's got an email address, and it's sort of getting that way, I think, for candidates and campaigns too. It's like, of course Hillary Clinton is going to do well online because she gets attention offline. And I think,
but actually, do you think she's going to do that well online?
I mean,
I wonder about the establishment. Don't you think the medium lends itself more to the anti-establishment candidates?
You know, I mean, I look at the top tier candidates right now, and I'd be willing to bet, at the end of this quarter, you'll see that all of them now, you know, on the Democratic side, John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, I bet you raised more online at this time this year than Howard Dean did in 2003.
But I guess we'll find out soon enough, but I'll bet you that Obama has more unsolicited donations coming in from people who just go online and search him and say, I want to give this guy $20. Than Hillary Clinton. There's just something different about the aesthetic of those two campaigns that suggests to me the internet will mean more to Obama than to Clinton. But that's purely
speculative. I certainly hope you're right.
Well, I know he's your candidate. And mainly because of the talent of his staff.
Yeah, I mean,
it's
clearly because of his web business.
But no, I mean, that's purely an intuitive reaction I have. Do you, I mean, do you, do you got, it'd be interesting to hear what the two Republican consultants think of the Democratic strategies online and how those two candidates in particular play.
Well, I think that, obviously Barack Obama does have a bit of a rock star quality about him. I think if you look back.
A Barack star.
Wow, there you go. Beautiful. I think if you go back and look at all the candidates who really have embraced and have really done well on the internet, John McCain 2000, Howard Dean, even Jesse Ventura going back even further, they all had a core message that was really resonating with people. And I think that is kind of the multiplier effect that the internet can have.
What is that core message?
Well, I don't know who it was.
They don't have like a common message. It's like.
Right. No, okay. It's just, it was a message that resonated with people. And I think that's the interesting part about this panel. The internet can make you president. I don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, it's not like I'm going to become president just because I have a website. You become president because you have a message, because you have a vision. And the internet is certainly a tool, and it's an increasingly important tool. But the internet alone isn't, people resonated with Howard Dean, not because, no offense, not because he had a cool bat. They resonated with him because he had a cool message or a message that people thought was cool.
And I think it's critical not to separate your online message from your offline message, that the two are one and the same. Like, don't try and go to the tech community and say, I'm all hip and tech. I'm unveiling all these latest tools and gizmos and gadgets. I mean, I think they're cool. Everyone here probably thinks they're cool, but I kind of recognize the general population is probably in a bit of a different place. And I think the key is being authentic about this. And if you're someone who's authentic, means what he says, do things people are attracted to you offline, they're going to kind of flock to you online. I do think, we haven't touched on video yet, but I think video, I think we got off television and onto the internet, and all people want to do on the internet is watch TV effectively.
And YouTube may have been the deciding factor in the Mark Warner camp, in the,
George
sorry,
Allen,
George John Allen. Warner, not John Warner,
George Allen,
George Allen.
George Allen, Jim Webb.
Thank you, yeah. George Allen, Jim. Thank you.
George Allen wasn't Blue State. Jim Webb was a Blue
Jim
State.
Jim Webb. Yes, no, sorry. Yeah.
Well, okay. You brought up the gee whiz gizmo stuff that people can do with the internet in a campaign. What this isn't. I didn't give you all much chance to think about this, but what do you think is the coolest thing that a candidate can and should do in a campaign online? And what do you think is the coolest thing that they can and should not do? Because I find that there are a lot of campaigns that think because you can do it, therefore you should do it, that it's a real big waste of energy and money sometimes.
I think the biggest shouldn't do is to, like Patrick was just saying, not be authentic, is to assume that you can have an online presence and just go out and buy it. This is not, an important part that we always tell our candidates is you have to be engaged in it. You have to believe in it. And you have to be authentic about it. And that's, I think, what the online community is looking for, is a real window into the campaign, a window into, okay, you're running for president of the United States. This is a very important position. What are you going to do about that? A straight talk for lack of a better term. And I think that is one of the important should do's, is be authentic, be yourself. And that works if you're running for dog catcher all the way up to president of the United States. Is that the online community, even more so than anything else, can smell, something that's phony and just spin.
We did everything on the Dean campaign. We would try anything. Someone would be like, well, what we should do is we should sell peanuts online to raise money. And we'd be like, great idea, and go do it. the list of what you shouldn't do is, I would prefer this panel to be how the internet cannot make you president. We had this one thing, called virtual caucusing. It was like virtual caucusing flash game, where you would go online and you would literally control a little stick figure guy that would knock on doors and tell people about a candidate, tell people about Howard Dean. Think about the level of ridiculousness here. The point is to get people to go offline. So, what not to do is anything that keeps people, on their computers, not talking to people. What to do is the opposite of that, right? Which is anything to get people, you know, talking to somebody else or for out from behind their computers because, well, it's good exercise and we, you know, like obviously the whole, like if no one talks about our candidates, then you lose.
You got to talk in first life, not necessarily second life.
Right. Yeah.
That's what I'm going to say. The biggest knock.
Yeah.
Not do a second life.
It's too bad Mr. Myers isn't here from the Edwards campaign.
Well, I mean, looking back, I mean, I remember there was a Mark Warner event in Second Life last August. There were about 30 people there. Half of them were political reporters wearing their generic white t-shirts, couldn't figure out how to sit down. And, you know, and so I think that's probably not going to get you that many votes, but.
Well, but experimentation is good, right? Yeah. It's about going into different channels and you know.
Well, let me say this. You probably, Clay, know the guys who founded meetup.com. I heard one of them talk about they originally wanted to call it America Offline because the whole goal was to get people to get out of these atomized, you know, computer terminals and interacting with the world, which the internet sort of moves us away from, but can be an excellent tool to sort of get us into society, but with people we share common interests with. That was the whole goal of meetup.com and why it became a great political organizing tool. You guys talked about on the subject of things people should not do. Let's talk about blogging because, and to your point, Mark, about the risks of inauthenticity and how the internet smells a rat pretty quickly. You know, blogging has become something you kind of have to do, but I don't know that it's necessarily such a wise thing to do. It can often come off as really inauthentic, and we've already seen the Edwards campaign have to put out some fires associated with blogging. What do you guys think is for your own candidates, how do you advise them to handle the question of blogging?
Well, Edwards didn't have a blogging problem, right? Edwards had a people
problem. Yeah.
I don't know whether you call it even a people problem. I think it was, you know, like, but it had nothing to do with, had Amanda been hired to, you know, be a finance director, it would have been, you know, sort of the same issue. Or it could have been the same issue.
The newspapers don't write stories about finance directors.
That's because finance directors are boring.
I know, but that's the point. I mean, Mark, you guys do. You're doing a blog for the McCain website.
We're currently actually still developing it. We're right now just getting encouraging people to get out into the blogosphere and start disseminating, you know, get their own blogs up there, do things organically. Obviously, yes, we will have a blog at some point that will have kind of an official campaign spin. But I think, you know, going to your point, you know, getting your supporters out there and empowering them to say, you know, here's our message. Go talk about this. You know, and connecting with other people is a lot more valuable than a campaign blog. I mean, a campaign blog can be a great tool if used correctly. But I think infinitely more valuable is supporters who are active and engaged and informed. And so you're saying, you know, as a campaign, our message is X, Y, Z, go talk about this. And it's a lot more authentic than, you know, to have people to people, reaching out and getting your message out there. And, you know, that's social networking of the first order. And social networking is not a new phenomenon. I mean, this is politics 101 that goes back to the days of, you know, ancient Greece, really. I mean, that is social networking at its core. And now we just have some new tools and there's some interesting new ways that we can use it to unite in ways that we might not have found otherwise. But at its core, it's about getting a message out there and giving your people the tools to get your message out.
I think campaigns need to focus on what their comparative advantages are. And campaigns, you know, aren't political. We're not political commentators. You know, I've done both blogging and I've been on campaigns, and they're two really separate things. And it's sometimes hard to get that distinction across. But what bloggers and particularly the political blogs are doing is comment. And obviously there is some action associated with those comments and some influence associated with those comments. But if a campaign tries to adopt, you know, the ethos and the mannerisms of blogging, it's just not suited to their style because there does have to be some form of message discipline and control. And I don't think we're ever going to kind of get beyond that. Obviously, I mean, I think, yeah, it's something I think any candidate in any campaign that has a blog needs to really just sit down and just say, what do we want this to be? and draw a box and say, this is what we're good at, and we're going to focus on that. So if we're good at getting out a ton of information each day, here are the links that, you know, you all should be talking about. Here's what we think's important. And you're producing, there's a lot of good press, you're producing that, you should get that out there. If you have a candidate who is good, I mean, we'll actually maybe sit down at the computer and actually write, or we'll sit down in front of a video camera and actually tape something every now and then. That will drive people, and they realize that, holy crap, this is from him. Then that's worth doing. But you have to be, I think campaigns have to be more judicious about these things.
Okay. First of all, I want to mention we're now halfway through this panel. And I'm going to reserve the final 6 to 8 minutes for the speakers to kind of give their closing thoughts. So if you guys have questions, there's a microphone back there that you can line up at. And while that's happening, I want to ask sort of my last question. You mentioned that 2008 might be the year of the boring internet. And Mark, you mentioned social networking sites. I kind of think MySpace and social networking might be the meetup of this election year. In my campaign, over the summer, we had 12 consecutive days of 100 plus degree weather. And I had 25 kids volunteering all summer on my campaign who'd been out block walking in it. And by about the 10th day of it, they came in and they said, can we show you a way we can block walk indoors? And they pulled up on MySpace, and I had, you know, fallen out of, I was not hip to MySpace. And so they pulled up 3,500 MySpace sites for people who live in the zip codes in my legislative district. And they said, instead of going and knocking on all these people's doors, we can just go and approach them directly on MySpace and ask them to add our campaign as a friend to their MySpace page, which it was the exact online equivalent of knocking on their door, was to ask them to add me as a friend. And when they added me as a friend, which meant putting my logo on their MySpace page, it was the exact online equivalent of them putting my yard sign in their front yard. It's a great example of taking traditional organizing strategies online. And they were able to cover a lot more territory using the internet than they were using their feet, and a lot less sweat. So thoughts on social networking going into this campaign, and then we got a line of questions for y'all.
It scares the thing that scares the crap out of me and keeps me awake at night is the camera phone and YouTube. because if you think, was the death of Howard Dean, then the camera phone and YouTube is going to be the death of,
of
everyone.
George Allen.
Right. Well, yeah, right. And it was, well, no, because what sort of, yeah, YouTube was, but not the camera phone, just technically. But you know, that's, I would imagine that there's probably going to be a million of those little things.
You better tell Obama if he says in the press he's going to quit smoking, he better not get caught smoking by somebody with a camera.
That's right. That's right.
Right.
Or his wife will be very upset.
In terms of what, you know, what's going to be important in 2008, you know, obviously, I think one of the big things from ours is, you know, we don't know yet. And, you know, if you had said YouTube back in 2004, you would never have really thought of that. But I think it's the continuing evolution of being able to do things well and do things efficiently. So it's much more efficient for you to be able to walk inside on a 100 degree day. And I think as the campaigns evolve, we're trying to look to do internal things a lot more efficiently, a lot more efficient targeting, a lot more efficient advertising, all those kind of things.
Okay, we got a lot of questions. I'll ask you to keep them concise and the answers concise so we can get to all of them. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Dave Young. I was working on Howard Dean's campaign as well.
Hey.
Anyway, I think it's going to be an interesting shift that we're going to see here in this next campaign as well, where there in the previous campaigns, such as Howard Dean's campaign, the focus was largely on the support network. It was largely on essentially a vote of confidence by many people. Since then, in the shift in the internet, there's been a lot more focus around the identity of an individual, such as YouTube, blogging is like really like, I mean, you keep on talking about all these things where basically, it has the opportunity to, instead of, focus in on the network uploading, the campaigns, speeches of Howard Dean that were really empowering, instead being a fireside kind of chat or a boxer brief conversation or a I'm upset because my M&Ms didn't have blue in them kind of blog post. How is it that you guys are going to be managing identity while at the same time providing focus on the support of the network of users? Thanks.
golly, I don't know. Is probably that's mainly because I'm generally incompetent, but at least not as competent as a Google employee. I mean, identity and reputation is a really, really tough thing. I mean, for us, our big thing is really qualification. Like, the sort of the DC Democratic establishment says Howard Dean sent 5,000 crazy people to Iowa, and called it the perfect storm. And, you know, what a stupid thing that was. And I would say that those people were not crazy. In fact, they were probably good natured people who I would bet, were not a harm, you know, were not inclined to harm themselves or other and knew the difference between, I don't know, right and wrong. But what they didn't know was what they were doing. I know this because I still don't really know what I'm doing. I think 2008 for, you know, these mass sort of movements has to be the year of education. There's an organization called the New Organizing Institute that's doing that. Hi, Roz. There's all sorts of other sorts of sort of in the community to sort of qualify people to say these are good volunteers. These are people who, you know, have went to Iowa and learned that, you know, we'd get people coming back that would say like, oh my gosh, you know, this was so awesome. I talked to him and he said he really supports John Kerry, but I marked him down as a strong supporter anyways, because, well, we really had a connection. And if he doesn't vote for us in Iowa, then he'll totally vote for us in New Hampshire. And, you know, it just didn't make any sense. I think that's online identification is, you know, open ID and stuff like that. But you know, the big deal is qualification, and that's what we're most interested in. I'm supposed to be concise, and I'm now rambling, so I'll just shut up now.
Hi, I'm Ted Adler from Burlington, Vermont, and I'd just like to say it's a great place to live.
It's freezing ever again.
You just got to learn how to ski. Anyway, my quick question is, we're coming up on a really interesting election cycle. I think this is the first time since 1952 where neither party has either an incumbent or the vice president as a candidate. And I think what happened in 2004 is there was an incredible, and living in Burlington, you know, you couldn't help but notice this guy, Howard Dean, that developed an amazing following. And I felt that the Democrats didn't capitalize on that once the party had to come together behind a candidate. And so my question goes to both sides. There are so many candidates out there right now, and they're all out generating a lot of support. Once the final candidate is chosen, how can the internet, or how will the various parties use the internet to maintain the enthusiasm that, you know, that the Dean camp had and bring it into the fold, or, you know, on the Republican side, you know, whichever candidate, you know, becomes the nominee?
Did before Dean became party chair, did Dean share his email list with Kerry?
Dean did some email sends.
He
for
did it
Kerry.
On behalf. That's the right thing to do, right? You make a commitment to the people who give you their email address that you're not going to give it to other candidates that gave it to you. But you ought to, I think the right thing to do is be an intermediary and send the information that the campaign, that the nominee wants out to your list, because you should continue to manage that list as strategically as you did when you were a candidate yourself. Do either of y'all have any thought? I mean, is that what you expect your candidates will do after the party chooses a nominee?
I think that, I mean, it's to everyone's advantage to kind of share information. And I think from on both sides of the aisle, they recognize, you know, an opportunity missed, you know, doesn't come along again. I mean, you have 4 years of waiting now. So I think that, you know, on both sides of the aisle, there's a lot of people saying, you know, we're going to develop some tools, and we're going to develop some targeting and things like that. And, you know, hopefully that everybody's going to be able to use that and can you develop that. And I think that the Republican Party has done a particularly good job, the RNC in particular, of developing a database and continuing to grow that and continue to use that for everybody's benefit. Because at the end of the day, we're united, you know, maybe not behind a candidate, but we're united behind a set of ideas, as the Democrats are. And I think at the end of the day, you know, the most important thing to us is that the ideas get advanced. Obviously, right now we're pushing for a particular candidate. But at the end of the day, the ideas are what matter.
Yeah, I can say at the RNC, there's been a great deal of continuity of effort on these projects, like candidates come, candidates go. There are some, you know, people you know, working in very strategic roles, you know, at the party that have been there forever. And those are our data people. Those are, you know, our list people. And so I think that has been a huge advantage for us at least.
And I think Clay would agree with me that, frankly, even though Democratic candidates have a higher profile of having used the internet successfully, I personally don't believe the Democratic Party is as well organized online as the Republican Party is. Clay, do you feel that?
I disagree with that, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. I think, I mean, the DNC, I think, is very well organized online now. They used to not be. But they're very well organized online now. And I think they're really, I mean, you know, in 2006, they did, I think there were like 3,000, local events all organized online. They knocked on about 1.5 million doors, for the election. I mean, they had two sets of national organizing days. I think they're really getting the 50, Dean's quote unquote 50 state strategy is really leveraging the internet in very interesting ways, that haven't been done before. So
I hope you're right. My experience goes several years before he was chairing. So I hope you're right. Yes, sir.
So as someone who was marginally involved in Mark Warner's appearance on Second Life, and incidentally, I was the guy who couldn't remember how to sit down. I think we missed the point about why that failed. And I think it failed because the Warner campaign, didn't really present an opportunity for conversation. There were a bunch of people in that room who were dying to talk to Mark Warner. They thought that was what they were there for, and it wasn't just reporters. And, I guess my question is, don't you think that it would be worthwhile if you can get a candidate into an environment like that to do so and to give him an opportunity to actually have a conversation, which may scare the hell out of him, but to actually have a conversation with the folks who show up?
I think the problem with Second Life is that until you can get as many people in a virtual room as you can in a physical room, it's sort of pointless, right? Like, I'd rather just have the candidate, you know, go sit in an auditorium and talk to somebody. But if you can only get 20 people in a room, then it's sort of.
Well, I was just, my response to that would be you get 20 catalysts and you have a record of it.
Oh yeah.
You know, you have to do an invitational.
But I actually think that the Second Life thing for Mark Warner was actually, a success. Not a success for the reason you'd think, but because he got press, and he got a media hit out of it, which I think is a really important thing that you have to think about when you're doing this stuff, because, you know, if you can be a first mover on something, you get a story out of it, and that's a big deal.
It's kind of interesting too, because, you know, back in 2000, anything that you did online was kind of like, gee whiz, wow, that's kind of cool. Whereas nowadays, there's a lot of, you're just, you know, bringing out old ideas and you know, refitting them. And so certainly, you know, experimenting with Second Life, experimenting with these kind of things, you know, may be valuable for the media hit, for, you know, whatever. But I think at the end of the day, you know, what we're focused on is, you know, core politics, getting the message out, making sure that everybody can meet John McCain. Because I personally think that if you meet John McCain, whether you meet him virtually, whether you meet him through an online video, whether you meet him in person, you're going to be drawn to him and you're going to be drawn to his ideas. So how can we use the internet to break down those barriers? And if Second Life's a way to do it, great, you know, and, you know, certainly we'll do that. But at the end of the day, it's about the most efficient use of time. So.
Hi, I'm Dave Fox. I'm a South by Southwest volunteer. And first of all, thank you for coming here today. I think it's very interesting. Two quick comments, one quick question. First comment, it's very refreshing to see Republicans and Democrats sitting together and not drawing blood. I think we need a lot more of that. Yeah. Think blue. Second comment, I think the death knell of any internet presence for a candidate is lack of currency of information on their website. If you see a blog that's 2 months out of date, I'm not going to come back to the website. Okay. So RSS feeds, anything you put on there to keep it current. And the quick question is, being on several email lists from several different candidates, at what point in time do you try and determine where you stop sending out information and start spamming? Because if I get, you know, 5 requests from a candidate within a 2 week period for fundraiser, I start canceling emails.
Mm-hmm. Do you though? Do you unsubscribe?
I don't unsubscribe, but I do delete without reading. So there's a repetitiveness factor that comes into play that says, okay, if I respond the first time for a fundraiser, don't send me another fundraising request for another month or something. You know, there has to be some logic to the message that's coming out that doesn't turn me off.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Patrick.
I think the biggest challenge for this industry and for people who do what we do is to find a killer app for this stuff that's not fundraising. You know, so, I mean, obviously that is clearly, I wouldn't necessarily say, I mean, is that the most impactful thing you can do with an email? We don't really know, because the reason that I think political folks are drawn to fundraising beyond we need to raise as much money as possible is it's the most quantifiable thing you could do virtually anywhere aside from election day. You know exactly, you know, this email performed 3% better than that email, which is, I think, you can't necessarily, I mean, you could say we got, you know, 10,000 volunteers out of this message. Well, I mean, but it's all in how you utilize those volunteers. I think a lot of people, there's always the pressure to send out fundraising emails. Yeah, we need to meet our first quarter deadline, but it's something that, you know, people can really grasp. They can really grasp the end outcome and how it will affect the overall campaign. So I do think that there has got to be a better search for how do we quantify some of these metrics that are non-fundraising.
Anybody else? I think it's the most difficult strategic question. And since I'm filling in today as moderator for Zach Exley, who did a lot of the online strategy for the John Kerry campaign 3 years ago, I will do my best to recount what he said to me about that question. Because I, you know, like everybody else, I said, y'all got to cut back on the solicitation and, you know, give, if you give more to your list, if you give them things to do besides give money, if you give them information that's useful to them, then when you ask for money, it'll mean more and you'll raise more. He said, look, how do you say to the campaign manager after every online solicitation has brought in $1 million, let's don't ask for money today? If it always brings in $1 million or more, or whatever the number is, it always brought in some tremendous amount of money that they wouldn't have gotten if they hadn't asked. It's how do you say no? Yeah, the money comes from a small fraction of the email addresses that the solicitation is sent to. And the rest of that body of email addresses is getting increasingly sort of disaffected. But each time you ask, you get money. And how do you say to the campaign manager, let's don't raise $1 million today?
You track open rates. I mean, that's really what it boils down to, right, is once your open rate, and open rates are becoming sort of increasingly unreliable, and everybody in this room is sort of smart enough to get why. But they, I mean, you can always measure relatively, right? If they're getting lower each time, then it's time to give the list a break.
And, you know, one of the things that Patrick just touched on, I think, is exactly right. If you go on TV, right, you buy X points on TV, your TV people can more or less tell you, okay, you buy this amount of TV, you're going to move this amount of points. It's harder for us to say, you put $1 million into your online team, we're going to move X points. And at the end of the day, it's all about winning elections. I mean, that's what we're paid to do.
What?
Next question, so we can get through the list.
So my name is Tim Bonneman. Some of the candidates have expressed a need for a genuine dialogue between citizens and the candidates, and an interest in having that conversation. Can you confirm that on both sides? And what kind of tools do you see are helpful and scalability issues? How can you have a conversation with like 100,000 or 1 million people?
I think all of our candidates want to, you know, and clients want a more direct relationship with their supporters. Whether I can say, you know, that I don't speak on behalf of Barack Obama or anybody. So, but I know that, you know, I think everybody sort of wants to have a dialogue with supporters.
Any comments on how you use the internet for doing that?
I mean, we do things like on the Obama campaign, we have a community blog system, right, where anybody can go and start a blog and talk back to the campaign, that's one way. I think we're going to see a lot of different ways for people to do so. I know that. Aren't one of you guys doing like a virtual town hall
with YouTube?
That's a really interesting thing to do.
Right. You know, encouraging people to put questions up there. I mean, they're going to put questions and they're going to put things out there. And you know, we certainly want to respond to them. You know, John McCain's always been all about straight talk. And I think a lot of candidates say, you know, there are going to be these things out there. There's going to be these disinformation out there. You know, we want to address that head on. And I think that's one of the things that's powerful about the internet. And it cuts both ways, is that a message that is, you know, a rumor about your candidate suddenly just moves at the speed of light. And if you're not on top of it, it can, you know, be a really bad story for you.
That's a really good idea, by the way.
You know what would be cool? Thank you. Is an online war room. Remember how the Clinton campaign had that rapid response war room? Look at the way the blog community outed the two senators who had tagged Obama, the Obama Coburn Sunshine Bill. Look at the way the blog community vetted the faxes on the Dan Rather piece right before the election, right? I mean, it'd be cool for your campaigns to develop sort of an online war room.
The Dean campaign did. It was good. It's called Dean Rapid Response. It's still going on. You know, it was an all volunteer effort.
One of these days I'll have an original idea.
Yeah.
And sorry, I think one of the things you did on Bush was like we posted, let's say, conference call audio for every conference call, every time we had a conference call with reporters. So people could go on and check, you know, are these, I think maybe part of the motivation is like, well, are these reporters, you know, asking fair questions? You know, people can go on and see for themselves and there's transparency to the process. I think part of the internet, I think old media, you know, thrives on scarcity, you know, scarcity of information. We're going to parcel out little bits of information here and there. I think the internet, you know, enables you to experiment with a new model that's just like, let's throw all this information out there and see, you know, maybe see what sticks, what doesn't. You know, it's easy for, of course, it's easy to say that. I mean, sometimes holding back to the right time works, but I do think you have, like, you could have a worm that has like 50 stories and you have supporters saying, all right, here's what we think is really interesting and important today, and have the community filter it.
Cool. Okay. Can I just quickly say, we have theoretically 9 minutes left. You guys care if we just keep taking questions?
Yeah, no, let's rock and roll.
Okay.
Okay. I was key volunteer on the Dean campaign in Oregon last go-round. I was also chair of budget and finance for the Multnomah County Democrats at that time. That's Portland, Oregon, and surrounds. So we've got a swing county and a swing state for the Dems, and we took Oregon, which was a lot in doubt in the course of that election. One of the ways we did it was that we had a peaceful insurgency of DENIACs that came in and revitalized the local party. And the way we did that was we drew people in from issue communities, from nonprofits, and we convinced them that partisan politics were both clean on a local level and open to new people with support for enculturation. We taught people, we had weekly intake to teach people how to do things like Canvas. Mm-hmm. My understanding of the way every single campaign site I've ever seen is talking to people either like they're idiots or like they're party insiders. But there's no bridge between vote for me because I want you to, and then, you know, I don't want to deal with you again, or vote for me because you know you got to because you're part of the machine. How can a political site get people enculturated and connected with the local party so that they are actually become party activists rather than just voters?
You tell me. I mean,
well, you know, I can tell you, but nobody's doing it. Right. You know, we did it.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It sounds like there is a bridge and it's you.
What y'all did was 06?
04.
Oh, you okay? So are y'all your DENIACs in Portland? Are they active through Democracy for America now?
Actually, I'd say fewer of them are active through Democracy for America than through the Multnomah County Dems. Right. We took over DNC,
right,
in Oregon. We were part of a block that helped vote Howard Dean into the post he's in now.
Yeah,
and it's exactly because the Dean campaign succeeded in doing something no other campaign ever did, which is bring outsiders into activism in the campaign, that he got to be, however problematic it has been for him and the DLC establishment, into the office that he's in.
You've probably heard about how effective the Dean operation was here in Texas. I don't know if you've heard, but we had God, it was amazing here. And it has continued to thrive after Dean's campaign ended.
That's happening across the country.
I mean, democracy in Texas
happened in Georgia.
It's become one of the found, but you're right. It's been integrated into the party.
Right. But unfortunately, in Massachusetts, it's not integrated into the party. I moved to Massachusetts since then, and there's a rusty old machine there that sits there and says, unless your grandparents were involved in the Democratic Party, we really don't want to talk to you, especially if you label yourself progressive, because progressives have, you know, like, don't understand how things really work.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like that everywhere.
Yeah.
You know?
I think you're right. There's a missing, the internet speaks to the super, super insiders and activists, and then it kind of puts information out there to the casual bystander and to the people sort of in between. It hasn't worked itself out yet.
The way I express this to people a lot of times is that politics isn't open source because it's basically the insiders pass things down from knowledge base to knowledge base. You have to apprentice to become a campaign manager, because nobody wants to talk about how they do it or what their tricks are, because somebody from the other side might pick up on that expertise.
You should go three people back to Roz Lemieux right there, and she can teach you how to do that stuff. She's
Well, I learned it, but I also taught it, and I got in trouble in my own party for sitting there and saying, this is how the party actually works from the inside, guys.
Thank you. Let's try to get to as many more questions as we can. I'm not sure we have an answer for yours.
Mine will be pretty quick. I just launched a campaign in the Southern District of Minnesota for Congress. So we're 2 years out starting. So we have a good deal of fundraising that we need to do, issues-based stuff. But what I'm really concerned is, how many points can we turn November of 2008 when it comes to online activity, mobilizing the people that are on your list? Even more so is mobilizing sort of peripheral voters that are in that margin that may or may not come out.
Are you the candidate or the manager or just an activist?
Just the online manager.
Yeah.
So,
how many points? How many percentage points can you win through online?
Is it 3 point? Is it 6 point?
Yeah, I think it's exactly the same margin that you would get from saying if I went on TV or if I go on the radio, if I put out print ads. The internet has a tremendous ability. I mean, it can be phenomenal multiplier effect if you have a good message and if you're connecting with people. And I think that as you know, I don't think that there's a particular number that you can say you're going to move 3 points. But I think if you're invested in it and if your candidate is talking about it and you're putting forth interesting, innovative ideas out there and you're saying, you know, here's how I'm going to solve X or here's what I'm going to do about Y, and you're driving a message and you're using the internet, I think that excites a lot of people. And I think that it's part of a larger point about your campaign. Sorry, it's not a very concise answer, but I don't think that there's a definitive answer for that.
I think my own experience might be the most relevant here. I ran in a district that was a Republican district. I ran as a Democrat. I used the internet. We did some online ads, you know, just to get my name ID up, very targeted to make sure we were only buying eyeballs in my district who could actually vote for me. But more importantly, what we did was we used the internet to make our field organization more efficient. You know, a good example. We had to get volunteers at 43 polling places on the day of the primary. It was my chance to introduce myself to the district. 12 hours of voting, 43 polling places. Would have been a logistical nightmare for an organization with one field person at the time. So what we did was we created a website with a drop-down menu of all 43 polling places. When you clicked on any one of them, it popped up a map of the location and what hours needed to be filled at that location. You checked off the hours that were available, that you were available at a site convenient to you. You filled in your information, and we got a spreadsheet on the back end that said who was going to be where and when. And we distributed our volunteer labor efficiently in a way that we could have never done doing it manually. That's the kind of, you can't measure how many points that moves the election one direction or the other, but that's the way you use technology to make your campaign more efficient. Justin Rubin.
Yeah, hi, I'm Justin, and I do election stuff for MoveOn, MoveOn.org. And I have two questions. One, what are the best ways to grow your list as a presidential campaign? And two, what is the role of your online program going to be in field and voter turnout this time around? My sense is in 2004 that on both sides, campaigns were using the internet and the web to engage people in voter contact activities, but it was kind of gravy. It wasn't at the core of, and I could be wrong here, and I'd love to know if I was, but it wasn't at the core of the of the field operations. And I'm wondering, is that going to be different this time around? And if so, how?
To tackle the first part of your question, I think I literally do think, I mean, it is capitalizing on those big moments, whether it's an announcement, whether, you know, the candidate is unveiling a new position, because that's when, you know, your Google searches are going to spike. That's when media attention is going to spike. And if you could potentially roadblock something to your website, whereas people have to go to your website to get something or have to sign up on their email to get something, that's going to be probably by far the most efficient way of doing things. In terms of internally, I mean, at the RNC, we did both kind of a call, a phone bank, and a go door to door thing, as a supplement, of course, to our main effort. But we did have, in hearing Mark describe it, very similar type, an extranet, which is kind of the behind the scenes, that makes these things happen more efficiently, makes recruiting the volunteers to actually man the phone bank more efficient, makes, going door to door more efficient. So there are some things like that weren't necessarily visible that we did. And I think that that's something the internet can, a lot of these really the most innovative tools can often be, make sense to be applied more internally than externally.
Yeah, I think one of the untold story or one of the stories that will be told about 2008 is the amount of micro-targeting that you can do and being able to coordinate sources within a campaign. I mean, previously, especially on a national level, you might have somebody, having a clipboard in Iowa and somebody having, postcards in New Hampshire, and it might go in the New Hampshire database and in the Iowa database, but not in a central place. Nowadays, I think candidates or campaigns are starting to understand that's not a luxury anymore. And so not only are you, Justin, but you're Justin who is interested in healthcare and lives in this particular area, and this is a message that might persuade you. And I think that being able to drill down to a very, very fine micro level is going to be one of the things that smart campaigns are going to be capitalizing on this cycle.
This has to be the drop dead last question, I am informed, and I apologize to those of you who waited in line so long.
Sorry. There seemed to be some agreement around two statements. One is that candidates will always care. Message control is always going to be really important. And two, that the anti-establishment candidates don't seem to have much of an advantage anymore. And it seems to me that the advantage that the anti-establishment candidates had, I think Dean and Lamont, was that they gave up some of that message control in exchange for like any support they could get at all. And so if going forward those two statements are true, how is it then that you all see the establishment candidates, A, keeping their message control, and B, allowing people to engage in the way that's now becoming standard, which is we own the message, we produce our own content?
For me, I know that the clients that we have that have the least to lose are the most fun to work on because they're willing to take more risks. That was Howard Dean in 2004, right? Here's a guy that was like sort of running around in a practically a Volkswagen minibus in New Hampshire handing out flyers. He was like, all right, I really never intended to be the front runner. And that level of experimentation, right, has the ability to pay off huge dividends, which gives a potential. It's like gambling, though. I also have the ability to, make $1 million at a blackjack table. That has the potential to do really well and great. But the establishment candidates have a lot to lose, so they just tend not to do it. So, I mean, to a certain extent, maybe anti-establishment candidates do, because they sort of can set fires where the establishment people can't set fires.
And I do think, it's certainly like Dean, Lamont, they were very, very successful up to a certain point. And then kind of the media.
How dare you say that about President Dean?
But and then the media honed in on them, and then the media started picking. I mean, you can get away
you
with
mean
a lot.
The man.
Yeah. You can get away with a lot if, there's not a lot of media scrutiny on you. You're just the 1% guy. Nobody cares what you're doing. How do we train? I mean, there's no one, I think, on this stage that wouldn't want, more open, comments and people creating sites and user generated content. But how do you manage it when your political reporters, who aren't necessarily as tech savvy as even most people, start saying, start freaking out about, what some blogger said about, that supporting you is saying about you. I think there's an education process that needs to go on with the media too.
think we're out of time. Mark, do you want to add something?
The only other thing I would add is, you know, one of the things that Howard Dean experienced was people might be disseminating a message and it might be the wrong message. Once you give up that control, it's hard to get it back. And, from a political campaign's point of view, you want people talking about it, but you want to also set the agenda. And I think that's an important part of what you're trying to do as a political campaign, is say, and your comparative advantage, I believe in this, let's talk about it. And if you're talking about it based on what I'm thinking about, I've already come way ahead. So that's kind of.
You guys, I've done a lot of panels at South by Southwest. This is one of the best ones I've had a chance to listen to. Thank all of you for your attention.
Rock and roll.